I'm Betty Comfort.
I'm sorry.
And Larry Welkman. Susan is here in Seattle because John Benson, who runs the new city theater, is unable to commission major important work and bring the artists to Seattle. And he has brought Susan Rice Hart and is down to direct the piece to Seattle, and Susan Maria has been teaching a workshop in playwriting. She is writing plays which are startling people all across the country because they're not like plays that we have all expected to find. Her play, The Last Black Man, was produced and published in the theater magazine down in the library, if you want to get a chance to look at it later. But we wanted to start out by having Susan tell us, first of all, where the idea for the Last Black Man came from, and then she very kindly offered to read us a bit from the play, so you'll get a feel for it. I have to tell you in advance that the graduate playwrights last year got the play out, and we had an assignment to read it, and we all decided that we really, really wanted to hear it. So we bumbled along, reading it aloud in class, because it's so much more exciting to hear than to just read from the page, and I think it would be fabulous. You can hear how it really should sound.
How I am.
So anyway, how did you get started?
Yeah, on this play. Yeah, as I was telling them, if you're walking there, I told this story. The death of the last time. I was asleep one day, and I was, which the premise, the way I started on this play has really confirmed what I've always thought about playwriting and theater, and it's really shaped the way I've thought about playwriting since then. I think when I write a play, I'm less concerned with my point or my message, what I have to say, more concerned with what the characters have to say, which is really what I have to say, but in a different form. And I listen a lot to the characters. So this play started, I was asleep, taking a nap, and I was dreaming about the title of the play. And when I woke up, I used to live in an apartment with a window and then the wall. And I woke up and I saw it written on the wall. The title of the play, which is The Death of the Last Black Man, the whole entire world, was written like that. And so I got up and I said to myself, you should write that down. And that's basically how the play goes. There's a voice in the play that keeps saying, you should write that down, you should write that down. And so the play became sort of this conversation in my head. I've all very strange, very woo-hoo, light candles and sit around and call me. That's what it was like.
Can we read some? Yeah. So everybody
has to hear. There are 11 characters in this play, and I call them figures and not characters, because figures are different from characters somehow. One of the problems with plays is to figure out how characters are different. But I'll read you the names of the figures first. There are 11. Okay, the first one is Black Man with Watermelon. The second is Black Woman with Fried Drumstick. The third is Lots of Grease and Lots of Pork. The fourth is Yes in greens, black eyed peas, cornbread. This is Queen then Pharaoh Hatshepsut, who is taken from an actual historical picture. The next is Before Columbus. The next is Old Man River Jordan. The next is Ham, you know, the biblical ham, and also edible. The edible biblical ham. the next is And Bigger and Bigger and Bigger, who's taken from a book, Native Son, you know, the God of Native Son, Bigger Thomas. And this God just kept getting bigger. And the next is Prunes and Prisms, which is taken from Ulysses, I stole. And the 11th is Voice on the TV. Okay, so I will read some of the poetry. Basically what happens in this play is there's a guy sitting much like this. This is why when I saw this chair, I thought, shit, it's an electric chair, because that's part of the play. And he's sitting like this throughout the play, more or less, like this, on kind of a little raised part of the stage. And in his hands, he has this huge, like, 9 million-pound watermelon. Except we only get to play in August, because watermelon. And his problem is, you know, he's trying to figure out, is it part of me, is it not part of me, the whole bit. He keeps dying and coming back to life throughout the play. You know, he'll sort of die and come back to life. And his... and his friend... wife, you know, quote unquote wife, is sitting here, and she has a fried drumstick, and she keeps doing this to him. She wants him to eat. Okay. That's all she wants. Eat, you know, come home, eat, shut up. He's like, where am I? Who am I? What's going on? So it's divided into seven sections. The first section is called the overture. Kind of tells you a lot about the play. It's more like a piece of music than a, you know, drama. And just like in a piece of music, in the overture, we get a little bit of what we're going to hear throughout the rest of the play. So I'm going to read part of the overture. All the 11 characters talk one after the other, and I'm not going to try to tell you which one is talking. You know, you can absolutely look and see. I will start. Okay, so first the characters say their names, more or less. The black man starts, and then the characters say their names. The black man moves his hands. Lots of grease and lots of pork. Queen and Pharaoh Hatshepsut, and bigger and bigger and bigger, prunes and prisms, ham, voice on the TV, Old Man River Jordan, yes, and greens, black eyed peas, cornbread, Before Columbus. The black man moves his hands, not yet, let Queen and Pharaoh Hatshepsut tell when. This is the death of the last black man in the whole entire world. Yesterday, today, next summer, tomorrow, just a moment ago in 1317, died the last black man in the whole entire world. Oh, don't be alarmed. Do not be afeared. It was painless, a painless passing. He falls 23 floors to his death. 23 floors from a passing ship, from space to splat on the pavement. He have a head he's been keeping under the TV, on his bottom pantry shelf. He have a head that hurts, don't fit right. Put it on to go to the store, and it pinched him when he walks. His thoughts don't got room. Why died he, huh? Where he gonna go now that he done died? Where he gonna go to wash his hands? Should that be? You should write that down, and you should hide it under a rock. This is the death of the last black man in the whole entire world. Not yet. The black man moves his hands. You are too young to move. Let me move it for you. The black man moves his hands. He moves his hands round, back, back, back to that, not that. When the world used to be round, the world used to be round, a round world, around the world. What is this? Columbus, before, before Columbus, before Columbus. Ha! Before Columbus, the world used to be round. They put a duh on the end of round, making round. Thus did it set in motion the end. Without that duh, we could have gone on spinning forever. The duh thing ended, things ended. Before Columbus. The popular thinking of the day back then in them days was that the world was flat. They thought the world was flat. Back then, when they thought the world was flat, they were afeared and stayed at home. They wanted to go out back then when they thought the world was flat, but the water had any dragons of which, meaning these dragons, they were afeared back then when they thought the world was flat. They stayed at home. Them thinking the world was flat kept it round. Them thinking the sun revolved around the earth kept them satellite-like. They figured out the truth and scurried out. Figuring out the truth put them in their place, and they scurried out to put us in ours. Yes. You should write this down. You should write this down, and you should hide it under a rock. Not yet! The black man bursts into flames. The black man bursts into blames. Whose fault is it? Ain't mine. Whose fault is it? Ain't mine. I can't remember back that far. And besides, I wasn't even there. Ha, ha, ha. The black man laughs out loud. Hambone, Hambone, where you been? Round the world and back again. What you see, Hambone girl? Didn't see you, I saw the world. I was there, didn't see you. I was there, didn't see you. The black man moves his hands. You should write it down, because if you don't write it down, then they will come along and tell the future that we did not exist. You should write it down, and you should hide it under a rock. You should write down the past, and you should write down the present. In what, in the future, you should write it down. Us, but you should mention them from time to time, so that in the future when they come along, you know that they exist. You should hide it all under a rock, so that in the future when they come along, they will say that the rock did not exist. We're getting somewhere. We're getting down. Down, 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 down. I saw Columbus coming. I saw Columbus coming, going over to visit you, to borrow a cup of sugar, so he said. I waved my hands in warning. You waved back. I ain't seen you since. In the future, when they came along, I'm meeting them on the coast. The coast. I was so polite, but in the dirt I wrote, ha, ha, ha. The black man, he moved. He moved. He hands. It takes a lot, isn't it?
Tell us what, where you got started in your life? What made you?
In high school, I had an English teacher who was, I'm sure the two had nothing to do with it, who was a nun. And she said, do you read? No, I don't. when you go to college, please major in anything but English. So I said, okay, Sister Mary, I guess I won't major in English. And I went off to college and I majored in chemistry. That was good enough. But, you know, I like to speak my mind and stuff. And you can't do that, you know, when you're. And so I took an English class and I loved it. And so then I loved writing so much, you know, that I wanted to recreate it so I could have the experience of reading something you love or seeing something you love or seeing a painting that you love. I wanted to recreate that experience. So, you know, I started writing. I had written as a child, you know, really didn't count. And started writing and enjoyed it a lot and got some, you know, okay feedback, nothing great. But that didn't matter. I would write these stories. I started with short stories. And one day, and I'm sure this happened to a lot of writers or artists here, I could hear the people talking as if they were in the room. So I thought, I don't care if anybody likes the stuff that I like. It's a really great thrill for me. So I kept up. And then playwriting, I wanted to do playwriting, but I took a class with James Baldwin, who would come to the Pioneer Valley to teach. He taught in Hampshire College. And I, you know, when he said, so who wants to read your work this week? You know, and everybody would count. I'd go, I want to read it. Because I'd love to stand up and da 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 da. And, so one day he said, yeah, you should try writing plays because you'd love to stand up and read your work to people. And that's like a play. And I said, okay. So, you know, that's sort of how I formally started to write.
When you hear voices.
Yeah. A psychiatrist asked me once, do you hear voices? You know, they were worried about my, you know, my mind. And he said, do you hear voices? And I said, yes, that's my job. We were talking at lunch about, David, and David is a
first-year playwright,
but who has done a lot of work in sound and music, and, you know, we were talking, gee, have you come to theater late, you know, and, which is like something that you could think, but to study music, and if you know the work of musicians, you know, the bar of music, and the phrasing, they're interested in phrasing, they're interested in breath. You know, if you play an instrument, you have to know where to breathe. You have to know how quickly you can breathe. There's a rest written in there, so you know when you stop blowing the horn, or when you, and all of that is so important to playwriting, and I think about it a lot. I was telling them that I really like Dionne Warwick. And so, you know, I listen to her music and do all these gestures. I never tell people that. That is true. There's a great song she sings about, you know, you can leave me, but if you ever get tired of the new person, come back and I'll still be here. Those songs. But you learn her songs, you sing along with any singer, you know, and you learn a lot about phrasing and rhythm and timing things that anyone involved in theater should at least have respect for, I think. And I put a lot of that into my work. And so when an actor sees the text, they say, you know, I might not know what my objective is, but I know how it goes. So they start with the knowledge of how it goes, and they find their objective not by sitting around and thinking about, you know, okay, so what's my objective? But they live it, they breathe it, and they find their objective for, you know, what they need to do that, which is kind of a different way. But yeah, music. It's a brain.
We're not going to have enough time, I think, for everybody's questions. So let's just open it up for questions.
Go. What do you want to know? Or what do you... Nothing.
Well,
I
mean, do you have objectives in mind for each character, and then do you kind of score it into the play? And what do you take the play in their hand?
I don't have objectives in mind when I write a play. I don't have the meaning in mind. You know, because I think that meaning is something that the audience, that's, you know, one of the audience's job to assign meaning, to tell me what it means. Or objective is an actor's job, because I don't understand what that means, objective. But I do know how I want it to sound. And I really believe that if I can write it on the page so that an actor and a director will know what it sounds like, that they'll know what to do with it that way. So the actor tells me their objective, you know. An actor who says, what's my objective? To me, I don't know what I don't know. But they can ask the director that, because the director understands that way. So, yeah.
What's your experience of, like, as a playwright, giving the work to somebody else to then make the music with, and how it sounds in your head as opposed to how it sounds when you have somebody else's head?
Right. It usually sounds better coming out of the act. I mean, it always sounds better coming out of the act, because they spend their time doing all this great training, hopefully. I spend my time doing training as a writer, so hopefully I can write it. They spend their time doing training as actors, so their voice is beautiful, their presence is incredible, their timing is brilliant. So it always sounds better coming out of an actor who has done their work. If they haven't done their work, then we have a problem. And I don't like working with actors who don't. And they don't like working with me because they don't have anything. It bears them. It immediately shows if they can't speak clearly, if they have crappy diction, and they don't care enough to work on it. It shows in the first 5 minutes of rehearsal because they can't hide. You know, my work. If you have bad diction, you can't hide behind, you know, something else. It shows. So, but it always sounds better. Not actors, all this sounds much more interesting. Yeah?
We're all going to get a chance to see new abilities soon. This is not the first production. Can you talk a little bit about the evolution of the piece and how you worked with Liz on staging it and realizing it?
Liz and I worked together, did it first in... I can't remember the 88 episode, did I say 1988? 1988, that's I had shown it to several directors who were, several theaters who were afraid of doing it. And then once I got into the theater, several directors who just, you know, were scared. And Liz was one of the directors who was just, you know, said, wow, I have some great ideas. That's how she talks. She's flirted. She's got to do all this stuff. And she was great. So we did it first in 1988. And we did, it's played in four parts, and we did the first part and the last part, because that's all we had time to rehearse. And then the theater liked it, and the audiences really liked it, and the theater invited us to come back the next year and do it again in 1989. And then everybody was crazy, started tearing their hair, and we had a hit on Off-Off-Broadway, and we haven't done it. We've had offers to do it, but we haven't wanted to do it.
The reason all through these
No, I wrote the play in 86, which it's going to be 91 now, so whatever that is. Whatever. And it did have some script changes from the first time we did it to the second, not in rehearsal, but I sort of, Liz and I talked, and I cut something, and I went away and changed some stuff, but it hasn't changed since then, 87, 98.
So a director will influence you to change, cut, or alter, but essentially you have a text, and your actors kind of learn the text.
Right. I don't like doing, I don't like writing in rehearsal. I think that unless it's absolutely essential, but I can't imagine it would be absolutely essential. But I think it is, it's not very respectful. I mean, I think it wastes people's time, I think, if an actor wants to learn their lines during a rehearsal, you have sometimes an actor comes in and they should be off book, but they're not off book, so they spend the whole rehearsal trying to learn their lines in rehearsal. That's the work they should do at home, and I try to do my writing work. It's also just easier to have all these people sitting around with me.
But those are also improv forms. But once you lay it down, it sounds like there's a certain rhythm. You heard it in, and then that's where it is. Is there improvisation built into the text for the performers, or was that your improv that you did when you were creating it, and now it's a piece of music that needs to just be learned and infused with the actors?
Like, what kind of space do I leave for an actor and a director? I leave a lot of space for an actor or a director. I don't really write in stage directions. So that, that could be a nightmare for a lot of people. Like, what do I do? And it's also great for a lot of people because you can do anything you want, sort of. It's like this weird power thing. But it's like a piece of music, very much. And if you think of how much space a piece of music gives you, think of a piece of classical music where you're not often encouraged to improvise or play with it, it still gives you a lot of space. In the work, in our writing workshop that we're doing, we were talking about the pirouette, ballet or dancers, actually, that term. In that form, in that very rigid shape, there is a lot of room for the dancer to fill it. And that's kind of what I'm doing. So that the beats and it's pretty set, but there's in that rigidity, there's a lot of room to play around.
What kind of process have you gone through in order to get it published?
this was, they just called me up. I'm doing this. They were doing new writing, and it was a new play, and so they wanted to read it. But I haven't worked too hard on getting public. I know that, you know, it looks good on the resume or whatever, and it's nice to hand people books and say, this is me, this is my picture. But, you know, I don't work too hard on that. Right now, people call me, but I have no idea what I'm doing. I think the most important thing is writing it and then getting it. We're trying to get the gig, getting it done. And if someone wants to publish it, that's great because then more people can read it. You don't have to keep photocopying it. Because Liz, in case you guys don't know, Liz is a white girl. A very white girl. Yeah, right now, Liz is like fabulous. She's wonderful for a white woman. Now, what would you say? No, it depends on, I think, the intelligence of the people involved. And what makes me mad is that people call my play a black play. And I've had people tell me, so if any of you come to the discussion after the show, on whenever it is, don't say that my play is about what it means to be black, because I will yell. Or I'll be like, I'll hate you, or, you know, I won't yell, I'll just say, yeah, there's another asshole out there. If you want to say that my play is just about what it means to be black, it has, you know, that's all, that it only has to do with black people, and therefore, whatever. And what I try to do is, I mean, I think if I'm in the world and I think about the big picture. You know, it's not just me as a black woman. I think my writing reflects that. And what Liz does is she also thinks about the big picture. And her directing reflects that. So there are things that there are a lot of things in there that she understands. There are a lot of things that she doesn't get on the first thing. But it's like reading Ulysses. I mean, if you're not from Ireland or Dublin, even, they are intelligent and think for themselves and, you know, have an open mind. Because Liz has done a great job.
Second question. Elaborate a little on the staging. You read The Last Black Man in our directing class last year, and we're really curious how you staged it.
Or how it was. Yeah. It was, the play is divided into all these sections. Really small scenes between the man with the watermelon, the woman with the drumstick. And those scenes took place on a little kind of an island, which was their porch, front porch. And then when the bigger scenes, the choral scenes, all nine other characters come in and start talking. And they just came in and then went off stage. It's not too complicated, it's really not. Yeah, it's really not. I mean, there was some movement, but I can't remember. But when they, you know, when they talk, when the guy in the script talks about a rope around his neck, there was a rope around his neck. It's really, when the woman talks, she has eggs in one scene, and she's dropping eggs into a bowl. She had eggs, and they dropped. A lot of people look at it and they go, ooh, it's weird, so it must be this abstract, obscure, you know, like theater that you go to and it's all cold, no emotion going on and stuff like that. But it's I try to kind of, I mean, I don't want to give people a hard time. Yes.
You have two more plays that you're convincing to write. Three more plays. And can you tell us anything about any of them, or do you have any production schedule for them?
One is, I'm writing three plays. Yeah, three plays. One is going up at the Humana Festival in March, I think, in Louisville. And another one is going up between 1993. Because that's when the theater has money to do it. And the other one is going up probably in 93 also. And they're all really
good.
I mean, I'm finally getting to the place where I'm combining some of, I mean, it's sort of starting, just starting to come together. I can fly way out there and the technique is just beginning to hold. So they, it's kind of fun.
You find your ideas kind of the same way, like they just kind of slap them into your, you know, wake up and here they are.
I sort of, they come a little, the first thing that usually comes now, well, because of this, and this is very much sort of a blueprint of what's happened in the 3 years that have followed right in the play, the title comes first. And then I go, oh, I was telling someone here that the title comes, and then when I know the title, I know what it's called, the play. So I call it, and it comes. It's very like that. So I call the play, and it comes. And then the characters come. And I know what to call the characters, like in this one of the plays I'm writing now. It's called Devotees in the Garden of Love. And the characters' names are, two of them are Lily and George. Both women, a woman named George. So I know, George, why is she named George? You know, it's a dialogue start. And you just start talking to them as if they're people. That's what they are. So I'm sort of, so I don't sit around, I don't think about like what the play is going to be or what I want to say. I don't know. I don't know what I want to say. I know what I try to figure out what the character wants to say.
Yeah.
what they're doing is, you know, good and, you know, the regular stuff. It makes them feel safe and important, which they need to feel so they can do their thing. And from, you know, I want a director to have an open mind and a good ear, you know, and to just be open-minded and daring and adventurous. Because I don't write those stage directions, and I don't write them in because I want the director to go, whoa, if I had a great idea, this is what we're doing. Great. Let's do it. Just make sure the actors say all the lines.
One more question, because
you seem to think like a musician. Who are your favorite composers?
Oh, God, that's horrible. I listen, let's see.
What kind of music turns you on?
Because
you're so concerned with sound. You're so concerned with sound and rhythm in your work. What right. turns you on?
What are those music? I love to listen. I mean, chord can be, I mean, this is, I like a lot of so yeah. long answers. But I love Dionne Warwick is great.
Right.
I mean, that tacky, like,
but,
you know, bum, 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 bum.
Yeah.
You know the way to San
sing one.
Yeah, and they're not singing lines.